Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. Here we are off one of our many walks down the canal. It's mid-spring now. We've just seen some baby geese. I've never seen geese so young before. They're yellow, the Canada geese. They're so cute.
They are really cute.
But we've just been talking about something and then decided, well, we'll record this. It's a bit of a ramble. We haven't really thought about it.
There is no topic.
There isn't exactly a topic. We haven't planned it, but this...
It's a pathless land.
Yeah, it's a pathless land. But this... just briefly fill you in of the conversation so far. And something which amazes me every day is what Pete calls the plasticity. The plasticity.
It's not my phrase.
Oh, whose phrase is that then?
I don't know. It's just, you know, neuroscientists got this term, the plasticity of the neurons.
Ah.
You know, it's just like the brain can be connected up in an infinite number of ways. All within the same basic pattern.
So this with plasticity of the human mind.
Yeah.
And how it can...
Yeah.
And the thing that just... As I was just just saying, well, I observe it in myself and I then observe it around me as well. And okay, I admit perhaps I'm just completely hallucinating every single thing here,
yeah.
But it does seem to be something which is real as far as I'm concerned, and if it isn't, I don't really care. But this ever-changing... I don't like to use the word creature, us human beings, how we are constantly flowing and changing. And I notice it in myself, you know, moving from one mood to another, from one thought to another,
yeah.
And how this new thought creates another train of thought that goes off somewhere else that perhaps then moves into an action that changes what you do tomorrow, that then... flows into another thought that changes your course again and your mood again and how you relate to a certain person at that particular moment, which
and
may
that,
then...
That sets up a feedback loop system.
Yes.
Because they reflect back to you or interact with you in a way that's at least partly coloured by what you said at the outset.
Yeah.
Or said or presented or gesturally expressed, etc. The whole kind of complex thing,
So how all the things which are going on, loosely use the term inside, come out into the world with bird song, come out into the world through speech or actions or paintings or all sorts of things, and then these things go out into the world and change things in the world, and their reactions to these things then come back inside to the inside. So we're having this constant exchange between what are loosely called the inside and the outside, just for the purposes of talking about it. But this plasticity of mind is, it's like you can almost watch somebody, like, you know how when you're standing on a mountain and you're watching weather or far out at sea, and you can see the weather changing really quickly, especially in the Lake District where it always does that.
Yeah.
It's like you can watch somebody and just see them changing.
Absolutely.
From moment to moment.
Yeah.
And this is what I observe in myself as well. I can feel myself just changing from moment to moment, and I just find it astonishing.
It is astonishing.
How I can be so different while still being sane, haha.
Says you.
Yeah. through moment to moment, and this flow and change inside myself. And also, just going a little bit further, we were talking about, well, okay, you know, why are we like this?
Yeah.
You know, how do we, what, do we have this capacity for any benefit to us? And of course we do, because this is what helps us humans to adapt to change and enables us as a species to survive.
We're very adaptable animals, for sure.
yeah.
compared with many others, you know, require kind of quite definite niches in the ecosphere. I mean, like that butterfly there, it needs cruciform plants in order to lay its eggs and for its caterpillars to feed on. Yeah? And there's others that just rely on the stinging nettle. That's it, they're specific to that. Bit of climate change, the stinging nettle dies out. They die out as well.
Yeah.
But human beings are everywhere, aren't they? They're in the kind of scorching hot desert in the middle of Australia. And they're in bloody Greenland and Labrador and way above the Arctic Circle in the north of Canada, living,
yeah,
doing stuff.
I know.
And they're on the International Space Station.
Yeah.
And if Elon Musk gets his way and Google get their way and Amazon get their way, there'll be a colony on Mars probably in your lifetime. I don't think it'll be a lot of fun up there, to be honest.
Yeah.
But they will. They're just incredibly adaptable. And, you know, look at the midges, man. Wow. I mean, it's something that you can't help if you try and think about it and get a bit of a handle on it. You just have to think like biology and evolution, don't you? And, you know, and think the human being under the rubric of animalitas. Yeah. You're going to get there again.
But I just can't help but marvel at it all the time.
I mean, as well as noticing it in yourself and the people around you, and of course once you notice it, you can't stop noticing it. It's one of them things.
You just notice it more and more and more.
Yeah.
But first you might notice it maybe day to day somebody changing. Yeah. But as you notice it more and more, it's almost like you can just like minute to minute, and then it's like second to second.
Yeah. But also historically.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you kind of get geeky about excellent BBC, what they call them, documentaries, you know, about there's been a whole lot of stuff about prehistory in Britain, you know, right the way from the Paleolithic, the Mesolithic, and then the Neolithic, and the changes, you know, and the effect of the Ice Age and all the rest of it. But just the changes on our history, you know, looking at documentary and where there isn't documentary evidence, looking at archaeological evidence, and people historically just demonstrate again this same plasticity, you know, to quite extremes, you know, in terms of what people believe, how they organise society on the basis of belief, how that's always mixed up with what they have to do to survive, with the material base, you might say, in Marxist terms.
Yeah. So we've got these interchange between the two there.
Yeah, and just how various that is, and that never ceases to amaze me, you know, because the range.
Yeah, and how they came up with bronze when we watched that documentary the other day—it's absolutely mind blowing.
Well, people were experimenting,
like,
obviously.
Human beings are so curious.
Yeah,
and they try everything.
Yeah, we're messing about with stuff.
Yeah.
Well, just some of these ideas and inventions can take millennia to come through. You know, you can see they're kind of the seed, and then take a long time to come through.
Yeah.
And it depends on so many factors. It's quite difficult to try some all, especially, you know, when the evidence base is fairly poor. But I mean, yeah, it operates on that level as well, is what I'm saying there, this plasticity and adaptability. And well, I mean, what is the lesson, you know, from observing historically the absolute diversity, the incredible and astonishing diversity of human thought, human invention, human modes of being, human ways of organising the character of the human being. And if we met somebody from the late Stone Age, for instance, I mean, biologically they're the same as us. They're not kind of Cro-Magnon or anything. They're the same as us. They're Homo sapiens, same as us. You'd recognise them, and they'd recognise you. But you started trying to, once you got some sort of common language, trying to share beliefs and and things, you'd just be utterly astonished, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Because it would just be so strange.
Yeah, the way they saw the world and themselves.
And yet this is still a human being, you know?
Yeah.
And
think if you were saying there, you know, what can we learn, what can we get from this?
Yeah, but also the lesson on this individual level that you've mentioned, whereby we're interacting with people within our own matrix, if you want to call it that. Well, I think the lesson of history and the lesson of observing that plasticity and fluidity in your own day-to-day life, in your own ordinary life, is that it actually would be mad to be kind of deeply attached to your own particular organisation. It would be an insanity.
Yeah.
You know, to regard this as somehow final or somehow the last word.
Yeah.
And therefore to be ready to kill somebody for it. That's the lesson that I get, you know. I say, well, it's kind of a bit arbitrary, really. It's an accident of birth. You know? I mean, I do think we live in a world, I think the modern world rubs your nose in all this.
Because it's changing very fast now.
It's changing very fast, and we've got all this information and pseudo-information at our fingertips. You know, you talk to your Android thing.
I know, yeah.
You know, and it talks back at you, you know, you say yours. What time is the next train to Birmingham, you know, and it tells you.
Yeah.
it's kind of crazy, but our noses are certainly rubbed in it now, as never before. Even though, you know, there have been plenty of periods where, through warfare and trade and missionary activity, that cultures have encountered each other. Actually, they always have, you know, human beings. Even, I say, you know, way back in the Neolithic, we're moving about like nobody's business. In boats and trekking and trading.
Yeah.
I mean, really, really way back, there's evidence of trade over thousands and thousands of miles.
Yeah.
For things that people wanted.
Yeah.
Gemstones, metals, metal ores, you know, this is like after the Neolithic, the Bronze Age. You know, the tin came from one place and the copper came from another.
Yes.
You know, was it copper from Ireland and tin from Cornwall?
Yeah, something like that. And they just found out how to combine the two. I mean, how the hell did they discover that?
Thousands of years ago, you know. So they did get about. So there's always been an awareness, I think, of otherness. And especially otherness in terms of, like, character structure, social organisation and thought and belief systems. Always. But never like now, you know. And of course, we have an economy that depends on people being individualistic, because that's what fuels consumption, which fuels production, which fuels exchange. It's actually just like the motor of the economy is in the high capitalism of today. Is the individual has to believe that he or she is an autonomous chooser of goods.
Yeah.
from a cornucopian choice of possible goods, and the goods that they choose somehow express their individuality. Am I the kind of person that wears corduroy or denim? Etc., you know. So, that tendency, you know, that bit of modernity is even more dependent on and even more illustrative of our plasticity as beings. It's never really been more in your face for that kind of complex set of reasons. Strangely, some people kind of behave as though that wasn't the case.
Why do you think they do that?
Well, I think, certainly in...
Because they're just not noticed.
Well, in cases where there's a commitment to something rather more fixed.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And you can see that in certain circumstances, a society might bring up its children to be quite fixed. And not to inquire. Because it's perceived by the elders of the tribe, you might say, that they do need to be very conservative in order to stay within the particular ecological niche that they're in. And when you've got kind of like hostile circumstances, you can kind of get conservatism, in which plasticity becomes the enemy. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's concerted effort to homogenise the character of the people through quite determined programs of education, what I was rudely called brainwashing, you know, and coupled with quite draconian punishments for apostasy.
Apostasy?
Well, that's when you say, well, actually, I don't believe this, that everybody else believes.
Yeah.
And they'll kill you in some cultures for that. That is punishable by death in some cultures. So you can see in certain circumstances, there's a commitment to fighting the plasticity, to try and negate it, to try and set something in a little bit more permanent in terms of character and thought, especially in the collective. Thought, you know, and individuality is not encouraged in those kind of circumstances.
But we've ended up needing it in the end because over time circumstances change,
yeah.
Which means that the tribe can't continue in the way that they always have.
The tribe encounters another tribe.
Well, yeah.
It's either through trade or exploration or through
war,
etc. You know, I've been reading about the attempts in the Gupta dynasty in northern India to re-establish Brahmanical Vedic religion in the face of invasions from people who didn't give a shit about the sacrifices and the rise of Buddhism, which was against the social order of Vedic religion, against the caste system, the Varnas, against it. Preached against it, against the sacrifices, regarding them as superstitious. You know, in the time of Ashok in the third century BC, there'd been this Buddhist empire. You know, and then later in perhaps maybe second and fourth century AD, Common Era, you more correctly you'd say. To push all that back, you know, but in the face of invasions and by Afghans and Turks and all sorts of people, you know, so those kind of circumstances arise all over the place all the time.
Yeah.
You know,
and
so
without this capacity to to adapt and you know change in this very fluid way, obviously we just wouldn't have survived as a species.
Well, certainly tribes, you know, where they're kind of what's the word? You know, just overpowered by imperialist aggression. They may not commit genocide. The invaders may not commit genocide, but very often, you know, they just rip out the belief system, and you end up with kind of completely dispirited people. You know, who just turn to drink, or you know, I mean, it can be catastrophic. Obviously, perhaps adaptable individuals do sort of rise above that, but people are not equally adaptable, are they?
And possibly depending on their, because we started this conversation before we began recording this, and we were talking about childhood and how you are formed as a child, and whether this has any bearing on allowing your consciousness to expand and allowing it, or rather discovering just how fluid it really is, which isn't a very good way to describe it. I'm trying to choose my words on the hoof here.
Well, it depends on a number of things, doesn't it? I mean, definitely for stock people's endowments regarding this matter, just their basic endowment, their genetic makeup, you might say, the given right at the outset is very, very varied.
Yeah.
Some people will be predisposed towards a kind of, you know, personal conservatism. You know, they'll get themselves formed and they'll damn well stick to it. This is who I am. Yeah. And others who are more exploratory, less tightly knit as characters right from the outset.
I like that term, tightly knit. That's good.
But it also depends on, you know, where you happen to land when you pop out from the bardo. out of your mother's vagina into the world. Do you land in California? Or do you land in Kabul? And you can just say, or do you land in, I don't know, one of those little communities up there on the ice? And a lot's going to depend on that as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
So immediately there's this first interaction ongoing between the given, the endowment, the original endowment of a human being, and the circumstances they find themselves in.
Yeah.
And you do find yourself in circumstances. That's probably your first conscious moment, finding yourself in circumstances. So it depends on a million things. And also, you know, did you have a lot of traumas? Were you tortured? You had a lot of pain, you had a lot of illness.
Yeah.
Etc.
But the reason I was talking about it to start off with was because I've just been examining my own childhood more recently, and as I've grown older, I've realised that my parents were actually pretty extraordinary, because they never pushed me. Is my phone going off? Because they never pushed me to the whole career thing, or being a certain career path. They never pushed me in any direction. It's not like they didn't care or anything. I didn't feel neglected, but I was always encouraged, but I was never pushed.
Mm-hmm.
But a bigger thing that I've realised is I was also never pushed into having a particular personality or a particular way of being.
Mm-hmm.
I was never, it just never happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually been talking to my mum recently about this and saying, well, was this a conscious parenting choice? Mm-hmm. Or did you and Dad sit down and decide to be this way? And they kind of didn't really. It was just sprung from their own personalities, I think.
Yeah.
But I think that made a massive difference to me.
Yeah.
Because I was never, even though I grew up in a Christian household, at the point where I decided that, to be honest, I didn't really believe in God, and, you know, politely declined to continue.
Going to Mass.
Well, we didn't do Mass. We're Church of England.
Well, they do communion now, don't they?
Communion, yeah. They were fine, and I know it probably upset them and everything, but they never guilt tripped me. No emotional blackmail. They didn't bring round the exorcist, you know.
Bad mistake, Edna.
To rid me of the demons that have turned me from God or anything.
Orange is not the only fruit.
Yeah.
That was a bad mistake. I'll have a word with your mother. See if it's not too late.
So I feel that this made this ability for me to be easeful with my fluidity of mind, mm-hmm. and of being.
But you're a Libra though, aren't you?
Well, possibly that has some bearing and possibly not. But when you're going back to what you were saying before about where can we go with this train of thought? Where is it leading to? It's leading to something that I've mentioned quite frequently on these podcasts, is that you were saying it makes it impossible for you to believe anything that's like still and concrete and unchanging. So religion's all out of the window, I'm afraid, and almost like believing in anything that's rigid and still. Well, actually, yeah, definitely, it's like, because you know that those things don't exist.
Well, certainly
the rigid still thing is actually just a complete illusion.
Yeah. Well, certainly on the basis of everything that we said, really, not not willing to espouse a belief, and on the basis of having espoused that belief, to be ready to kill somebody else who believes something different.
Yeah.
Which seems to me to be something that's very common historically and in the current epoch, and to be really, really stupid. So, also, there's this thing about travelling light. I mean, people believe stuff, presumably, because it helps them to get by. It helps them to make their way through life, from birth to death. It eases the passage of what is, can be quite a tough business.
Yeah.
And again, like historically, you know, we've just kind of got used to it being like that, that you believe something, you know. And somebody might say that to you, you know, it's a social gathering or something. So what do you believe then? You know, and I mean, that's such a kind of popular opening gambit in many ways, you know.
Well, asking people what they believe.
Yeah, it's expected that they will, that they'll have something.
Right.
You know, it's a bit sort of like what football teams you follow.
Yeah.
They presume that you will follow on. It's so kind of ingrained that we have this little helper to get us through, you know. That sometimes isn't just a little helper, but a complete, you know, but an item of fanaticism and homicidal readiness.
That's a good term.
You know, so, but I kind of think, if I don't need it, why put it on my shoulders?
Yeah.
I want to travel without great weights on my shoulders. Yeah. And I do find I can travel light, pretty light, yeah. To be honest with you.
Because the weights on the shoulders just blur the vision, rather.
Well, it might.
It's almost like putting a pair of blinkers on.
Well, it does that. It definitely does that. But it also kind of like wears you out. And I'm glad I'm walking along here with nothing but this eddy roll, which probably weighs like half an ounce.
Yeah.
And not much else. Got a bit of money. Got my key to the front door. Got my specs. Got my miniature computer in my pocket with which I can communicate with the entire world. So what wood do I need? And I'm really glad I'm not carrying a brick in a rucksack.
Yeah.
Yeah, travel light. I'd do my agony aunt thing, you know. Travel light, people. You'll find, even though it will feel strange at first, that you are perfectly capable of moving between birth and death in a light and fluid fashion, with very little weight upon your back.
So moving out beyond.
I think it's a great good. If you can travel light.
Yeah, definitely.
This is what I find personally.
Well, just coming down to the personally. Okay, so you know, this noticing in myself this fluidity means that, yeah, you know, I'm not believing anything in anything. You know. Grand narratives,
yeah,
that are unfixed, that are fixed, yeah, and unchanging.
Yeah.
But also, when it comes to me,
myths are for entertainment. People have forgot that.
Yeah. It's almost like it becomes impossible to believe that there is a self in.
You always say that at this spot.
I know, I do, don't I?
Yeah.
But you see, it always takes. I think this way, I just find it so amazing all the time. I do mention it frequently because I do really, really do think about it frequently, yeah. And I feel amazed by it every day.
Yeah.
I think, oh look, I'm different today. And I guess it's boring to just keep saying that, I know. But yes, how can you believe or experience yourself as a solid and unchanging self when you're hyper aware of this fluidity of being and constantly changing?
Yeah. Well, this is one way where you you might find solidity when you looked, and that is because you've been subjected to a very concerted process of education and socialisation, which actually is a physical process of widening up the brain in childhood when it's at its most plastic, so that you will be, as your parents, family, village, society desire fervently, that you become a good Zoroastrian or whatever it might be, good Catholic, good Methodist, whatever.
Very lucky.
Just those guys, isn't it? I mean, it's a process that sort of semi works. You know, whereby the wiring is pretty, by the time somebody's like 16 or something, it's pretty well in place. You know, the default state network.
Yeah.
Which deals with identity and your everyday processing. It can be pretty fossilised after a concerted effort to set everything up. I mean, sometimes, you know, pain is used, torture, initiation, you know, painful physical initiation. With Australian Aborigines circumcising 15-year-old boys to make sure they're in the tribe without anaesthetic and using a piece of broken glass.
Ooh.
That focuses their mind, that tells them where they belong.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
You are a bearer of this mark, you belong to this tribe that administers this mark. And education is physical because it wires the brain in a certain way.
So you had a bit of a similar upbringing to me in the sense that you weren't, you were a bit of a wild, like let's run wild as well, weren't you?
We were feral.
Yeah.
That was the way.
Not to say I didn't have boundaries, but like we're very different childhoods. I mean, completely different eras, really.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but neither of us were, I don't know if I can, you know, emotionally and mentally
not
constrained.
That much. Not that much.
And forced into a particular box, were we?
Not that much, no. Any attempts were pretty half-hearted. And also resisted right from the outset. And because we were feral, we weren't around adults except in school, you know, and school's just this inconvenience that you turn into an entertainment. So, no.
Yeah. Actually, yes, even in school, there wasn't a particular indoctrination to be a particular way. I mean, either that or I really wasn't paying attention.
You probably weren't paying attention.
I probably wasn't paying attention, to be honest. I remember those years of just like kind of pleasantly drifting.
Yeah.
Writing stories about snails.
Yeah, well, there you go. Well, you know, we do live in a society, as I say, which celebrates individualism. Not necessarily for altruistic reasons, but for economic reasons, really. But it's a bit of a rarity, you know, on this scale, in global terms. So you might say that we're very lucky.
I think we are very lucky.
To be alive in this place and this time.
Yeah.
You might not. You know, Trump has got his finger hovering over the button.
Well, there is that.
You know,
yeah.
So we might not be here this time next year.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, it's like a time of the maximum terror. And the maximum opportunity, seems to me.
Yeah. is all the openness and possibility for all the amazing things, and fortunately opens the door for all the really bad stuff as well.
Yeah, it's time to grow up then, isn't it?
Yeah.
You can see when you're 18, isn't it?
And we talked about this thing about social evolution and how it seems that, well, I certainly feel this really strongly, that human beings are really only teenagers. They're like, we're like 13 in our social evolution.
Yeah.
This is why we're doing all this really dumb stuff.
Oh dear.
And if you look around and you look at all the dumb stuff that's going on, you know, you can imagine, 13-year-old, particularly a 13-year-old boy, sorry boys.
It's the raging hormones, isn't it?
Yeah. We'd be driven a bit by and do some dumb stuff.
Teenagers apparently are prone to like high-risk behaviour.
That's right, yes. And that's what we're doing.
And it's something to do
that's
with...
what we are doing.
And that's probably something to do with where their brains are changing really, really rapidly.
And we're still exploring our world and our possibilities.
Oh, absolutely.
You know.
Absolutely.
What will happen if we press this button?
Yeah.
You know, we're exploring believing this and believing that and seeing what happens.
And all that kind of mad technological curiosity that's always been around, you know.
Yeah.
The same thing that produced that kind of river of molten bronze.
Yeah. Still going on.
It's still going on. And,
to be honest, like the mobile phone is almost as amazing as...
It is totally amazing.
Bronze.
It is, yeah.
You know, really.
Yeah, well, that was obviously an epoch-changing development, which spread, you know, it spread from, I don't know where it was, but it started off somewhere on the Mediterranean, but it spread worldwide eventually, obviously.
Yeah.
And was just epoch-changing, you know. As were things like your development of agriculture, discovery of the use of fire, language.
Yeah.
These are big
numbers.
And some of the IT, you know, the digital technology. The Turing complete machine, the invention of that, to my mind, is as epoch making as anything that's happened. Okay, what's the result of that? You know, people playing mindless games on little screens on buses, you know. But
going back to kind of, you know, what can we get? You know, you were saying old travelling light is like, you know, a positive thing.
Yeah.
Useful thing. Makes life... I don't know exactly about more pleasant, but... more interesting, certainly.
More interesting. Yeah.
And I think ultimately more relaxing.
Yeah.
Do
you ever hear that thing, there are no atheists in foxholes? It's fucking not true.
Yeah. I think that's probably where we lose religion,
I mean,
to be honest.
Voltaire, you know, what did Voltaire say? Écrasez l'infâme. Eradicate the infamy. What was he talking about? The Catholic Church. He fucking detested it. And the complete scam. The religion of his day.
Yeah.
It was just a complete scam, and he satirised it mercilessly.
Yeah.
But when he was dying, somebody sent a priest to him, you know. Said, we bet he'll do last rites, but he didn't.
Yeah.
Hume, the same. I mean, Hume was an atheist when it was career suicide.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. Right.
No.
This is the kind of cleverest man of the age. And it was refused the chair at Glasgow. Very venerable university, you know, they've been around since the 13th century. Hume applies for the chair of philosophy, or moral philosophy probably. Didn't get it. Couldn't get employment in academe. And he was streets ahead of everybody. He's the most brilliant man of the age, you might say. And when he was dying, he just, as people said, did you recant? He says, no, I'm all right, I'm fine.
Yeah.
Actually, I think you could go into a foxhole, a staunch Southern Baptist, and come out of the foxhole a militant fucking Richard Dawkins style atheist, you know? Because you think, well, if there's a God, why the fuck's he letting this all go on?
Yep.
I mean, it's, you know, it's a basic response, you know, the problem of evil that religion has, is often challenged with, daily it's challenged with. Look at these campions, man, they're vigorous ones, aren't they?
Flowers down here are amazing at the moment.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say,
it's hard to believe you're in the thick of everything here. Right, okay. In the middle of all this industry and traffic and buildings, and there's this kind of absolute lush burgeoning of Mother Nature.
Yeah. But what I was going to say was, being aware of this fluidity of being really paves the way to be absolutely delighted with oneself.
Yeah, or with the world as well.
And you know, starting off with the self and then expanding out into the world. But when you looking at yourself and feeling this movement and this fluidity, it's actually on a very, it's a daily basis, yeah, amazement,
yeah,
and a great possibility, yeah, of being delighted, and as a little side effect of being delighted, actually being happy and enjoying your life and being
happiness
fascinated and curious and all the other life enhancing qualities.
Yeah. Again, you say a criticism of the kind of skepticism that we've kind of talked about here, which, you know, you travel light because you're skeptical on the basis of historical study and self-study of fanatically held belief. Yeah? Because you're sceptical of that, that somehow life will have no wonder, that people take on belief to open up to wonder.
Yeah.
And if you're a sceptic, you're some kind of like dry person, you know. And this is an argument that you hear. And again, it's not true. Uh-huh. It just isn't true. Skepticism,
certainly not true for me.
In clearing away the temptation to live inside a story, instead of actually let the wind and the rain get on your skin, and the sun burn the top of your head. Actually, you know, living in a story actually attenuates wonder. You don't have to wonder about anything. It'll be amazing anything, because you've got the answer there in the book,
yeah,
or in the story. And that's dead, you know. And actually, scepticism and wonder are intimately related in the way I've just outlined.
They are,
and not.
And in fact, we're going to do a talk later this year called.
excuse me.
We're going to do a talk later this year called Wonder and Scepticism.
Yeah, or scepticism and wonder.
Actually, I think it's nice the other way around, but.
Yeah. Well, there's a thought.
Whatever.
Well, yeah. Well, we'll find the best way.
Yeah.
We'll find the best order.
But yes, scepticism certainly does open the door to wonder like nothing else.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, I feel surprised. It's like, makes life so much more interesting, because every day I'm just completely surprised with myself. And it sounds like, I don't know, you don't really want to bounce around going, I'm just so delighted with myself, you know.
You can get you locked up.
But I actually am. I feel delighted and amazed at myself every day. Like, what's going on here? And nothing ever happens the way I think it's going to happen.
There you go.
It's just, the life is just an unfolding mystery all the time. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be great, you know. Just because it's an unfolding mystery doesn't mean it's going to be a marvellous mystery and, you know, everything's going to be pain-free, of course. But no life ever is for anybody,
nope.
No matter what you believe or don't believe, because shit happens and it's just the way it is.
Shit happens.
Yeah. And I would like, if possible, for more people to be able to be as delighted with themselves as I am.
Why?
Why should you? Really, why, great, man.
Why should you care?
Because it's kind of really great. I just have this weird urge that I would like the humans I share the planet with to, well, I'd kind of quite like them to be happy.
Yeah.
And free.
Yeah.
Free of cultural constraints, free of painful beliefs that force women to do this and that, or force men to do this and that.
Yeah.
You know, and limit their potential.
It's all shit,
isn't
it?
Close them in and squash them and crush them.
Yeah, it's all shit.
I would really like it if people could be free of that, because I feel, and okay, I could be just totally hallucinating here, I feel I am free.
You are a utopian.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe not completely free, but what the hell? Pretty darn free. And it is great. It gives you the capacity to be delighted from moment to moment with yourself and everything that's going on around you and other people. I would like other people to be able to have that too. You must be pretty delighted with yourself. Go on, every morning you wake up, I bet you think, God, I'm amazing.
Every morning I wake up, I think, fuck me, why didn't you kill me in the night, you bastard? You don't exist, it proves it.
No, you don't.
I'm generally all right when I've had a cup of tea. A cup that cheers. That does it for me, really. Nice cup of tea in the morning.
Aye.
Strong and fresh.
My tip, Lucas, if anyone's interested, don't really drink coffee very much, but we have what we call Parkdale hot chocolate. If you get a very good quality cocoa powder and put in 4 very, very heaped teaspoons in a cup, and get yourself a small cup whisk. Put your hot water on it and whisk it round as soon as you can. Leave it to soak a bit if it goes into lumps.
Sludge.
And put a bit of milk in the bottom, yeah, in the cup there, and then just knock it back. The high that you get off that is well beyond coffee. Above and beyond.
Is it?
Yes. The drugs are far, far better. So Parkdale hot chocolate, just try it, kids.
There's a love drug in chocolate, isn't there? Phenylethylamine. It's a bit like oxytocin, you get loved up with that one.
Well, you do feel amazing.
We forgot to mention oxytocin the other day, didn't we?
We did. We only,
we like oxytocin.
Maybe we'll do our next talk about oxytocin, because we're coming to the end of our walk now, but it's very important. But
I don't actually make my hot chocolate like that. My method is completely different.
Yes, well, we'll talk about your method another time, but let's leave
some. Oh, we will.
Oh, go on, okay. It's only fair that you tell them your method as well.
I swore at the outset with this, no recipes, no knitting patterns.
Okay.
Right? And I'm going to stick to that now. And I'm going to be dogmatic about that. That is my firm belief. And I'm willing to kill anybody who challenges me on it. Is that this is not the place for knitting patterns or recipes. To be honest with you. Or even any kind of agony aunt shit, really, you know. But we kind of keep slipping into it because you think, well, why are we doing this? Well, I don't know, we're just being self-indulgent and vain and narcissistic because we think we're great. But actually, we've got this kind of addled, mixed up notion that it might be useful to somebody.
Yeah, well, you never know. This is how we see what we do. We just see, like, we get a handful of seeds and we just throw them out into the world.
It's like blowing a dandelion clock.
Yeah, and maybe some of them will germinate somewhere and grow into something, and maybe they won't.
This is the West Midlands Canal Network on this map.
Uh-huh.
It's just far more extensive than you think. Look at all this.
Oh, yeah.
It goes to Block Switch, and then right the way up to Brown Hills, and then there's one going north up there. And there's a loop here, look around here. Where is that? Warsaw. Birmingham. Stourport, Llangollen, Chester, Stoke-on-Trent.
Aye.
I don't know where it goes out, where these ones go.
Well, they just go off the edge of the map, don't
massive,
they?
Isn't
probably,
it?
Yeah. It's a pretty big network from here.
More canals than Venice, apparently. Well, they go for miles, don't they? They go for hundreds of miles.
Yeah. Anyway, so, the seed analogy. Maybe some of it will get out there in the world and germinate.
It's good for everybody's garden with weeds.
With weeds, yes.
And when they want nice ordered
flower beds
with straight lines.
Yeah, and we are the dandelions between.
We are the dandelion people.
Yeah, dandelion people. Anyway, we're at the end of our walk now, so goodbye, dear listeners.
Bye.